This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning and welcome to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kunnison. Over the last few decades, corporate earnings and worker productivity have risen, but real wages have stagnated. Why is this so? Well, the profit paradox points the finger at technology and market power by dominant firms. So today on The Breakfast Grill, we explore this paradox with economist Jan Eekhout, author of The Profit Paradox, How Thriving Firms Threaten Their Future. Jan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So Jan, your book is fascinating and I really wish we could pack everything into this conversation, but we're not going to be able to do that. So I'm just going to pick out some key points and see where we go from here. And let's start off with a few basics. In your book, you attempt to break down the factors behind essentially the atrophy in labor markets we're seeing. Corporate earnings are up, worker productivity is up, but real wages haven't caught up or haven't followed suit at the very least. And one of the factors you've noted in the book is the role of technology here, which, as you note, has made skilled workers disproportionately more productive. Jan, that sounds a good thing. Why is that holding back wages?
Well, there's the fact that technology is disproportionately affecting what we call the high skilled, the people who are more productive, and less so the less productive. And that's causing the dichotomy, if you want, between high wage earners and low wage earners. And this is also related a little bit to this superstar phenomenon that, you know, with globalization and new technologies, people who are very productive can basically scale their productivity worldwide and therefore make massive earnings. But if you're flipping a burger or if you're driving a truck for some company that delivers, then you have much less of such scale and therefore much lower wages.
So one side, we've got high-skilled workers. We've also got superstars, and they're making disproportionate amount of money than before because of the developments we've seen. They're more productive because of technology, but they've also got greater market access and scale. But Jan, isn't this, I guess, part of the cost in this globalized world, though?
It is, and it's something that's, you know, when we talk about the future of work, this is something that we have to deal with, and that will not, you know, will not get less so. I mean, this is, you know, I think we're fairly globalized and integrated already, but it can be more. And this phenomenon is there to stay. What is important to recognize is that there's the majority of the workers who don't have that scale, mm-hmm. right? Because driving that truck for delivery or flipping a burger in a fast food restaurant, you may be part of a global chain, but what you're doing is really a very localized job, not scalable. And that's where this difference is really coming from, that, you know, the majority of these jobs are not scalable, and then a few jobs, probably increasingly few of them, are extremely scalable. And that's where this big difference is coming from. But again, I want to stress, this is there also without this rise of what I call market power, this dominance of firms. What this dominance of firms does is it makes it bigger. Mm-hmm. Why does it make it bigger? Because where the share of these superstar workers is coming from is in part from their productivity, but also in part for how much profits they generate for their owner or for their employer. And if these profits go up, they can basically grab a bigger share of that. And that's why this difference is also even further exacerbated.
Right. So let's dive into that then. In the book, you talk about market power by dominant firms. And you take some time here to explain the origins of this dominance, right? How it came about. Could you take us through this? And then we'll dive into, I guess, the harmful consequences of this market power.
So in terms of the origins, in broad lines, I mean, the world is obviously very complex, but in broad lines, there's two sources that are at the origin. One is purely technological, and that's the main one. The other one is more an issue of, you could say, lack of antitrust enforcement. And that's kind of a difficult way of saying that over time, some firms have had it easy and without much opposition to merge, where they really are merging for no other reasons than to create market power. So one example could be the fact that Facebook has merged with Instagram and WhatsApp. That was fairly clear that this was creating market power and was not, you know, beneficial to the customer. those are fairly well known, and they are subject to antitrust, maybe not enough enforcement, they're subject to this antitrust. What is more complex and also kind of more difficult to handle is when technology, fast technological change, is the cause of that market power. And then I'm thinking of companies that have grown, as we say, organically. It's not because they've taken over other firms, it's just that they actually did grow very fast. But it's growing, and this is happening now because there's a kind of very rapid technological change. There's new technologies that opens new possibilities, new markets, and these new opportunities are only going to kind of give advantage to one or a very few number of competitors. And these few competitors is one competitor in, for example, the case of Amazon. There's only one big player that can build such a distribution logistics network. And what this means is that with what we call scale economies, there's really only place for one big player. And then one big player has a very positive effect on the economy. That one big player is extremely efficient. They can deliver the goods to your doorstep at a much lower cost than any of the competitors. So that's great. The cost is that because they're the only one, there's no one who can really get close to them in terms of being so cost effective. The implication of that is that they don't have to pass on these gains to the customers. So they set prices which are lower than their competitors, but they could be a lot lower given how efficient they are. Why is that? They don't face competitive pressures because there's no one as efficient as them. And I think that is the big challenge of where the important source of this market dominance is coming from. Yeah. Understanding how this works and how we can deal with it.
I guess the common theme here we really drive down, Jan, is all in all, is it as simple as saying that technology is the villain behind the current state of work? Because we've got big tech companies, we've got technology rapidly shifting over the last few years. Is it as simple as that? Or is there another villain, a big bad behind the scenes?
I think that technology, using this language, is the villain, but also the hero.
Okay.
And this is, you know, this makes for a good Hollywood movie. why is technology first the hero? The examples I've given, all these firms have made enormous investments in this technology, using these new technologies to basically become more productive and lower costs. And this is good for society, this is good for the customer, this is good for everyone. So this is where technology is the hero. And I make a very kind of adamant point that we have to embrace these technologies. We cannot just, you know, get rid of them. Right? We have to, in fact, I would argue that we have to foster even more innovation. Why is technology at the same time the villain? Okay, and here the villain, I do not refer to one particular individual, one particular firm. I refer to it as the economic system. Mm-hmm. It's the villain because these, you know, very productive firms, they actually, you know, they're so productive that they're not facing any competition. And this kind of high productivity has made them so different from anyone else that they don't need to price competitively. If there was seven Amazons out there competing with each other, you would see extremely low prices, even lower than they are now. But because Amazon is alone, you don't see that. The same thing with Facebook. How can Facebook lower its price? Well, you know, you pay nothing for their services, but they could offer you things. They could offer you Netflix for free. They could offer you, you know, other services that are now content that is for pay. They could offer this to you. That would be another way of giving you a better good for the zero price that you're paying. And we don't see that because they're the only one in the market who is so efficient, so productive. And therefore, the villain is the fact that, you know, that technology has made them so distinct and different from competitors that technology is kind of causing a problem here.
I've been speaking with economist Jan Eckhout, author of The Profit Paradox, How Thriving Firms Threaten the Future. And you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. Keep it here to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanizan. This morning, I'm speaking with Jan Eckhout, author of The Profit Paradox, How Thriving Firms Threaten the Future. Jan, when you talk about market dominance, it aptly reminds me, and as you noted in the book as well, of the quote-unquote robber barons of the early 1900s, right? We had the rise of rail oil finance with legacy names like John D. Rockefeller, Charles M. Schwab, J.P. Morgan, and Andrew Carnegie, all still very familiar names. They made astronomical wealth for them and their families in a parallel sense. It's something we're seeing with big tech today. So is this general skewed distribution of wealth and the wage inequality that comes from it, is it cyclical in the terms of a longer term basis and pretty much inevitable?
I think the short answer is yes. And the reason why is because technology comes in spurts, right? And what I mean by that is, of course, things are invented all the time. But what I mean technology comes in spurts is that from an economic viewpoint, from productivity aspects, this, you know, you need kind of the stars to align before something really makes a big difference. And I think the examples that you gave from the early 1900s were a set of conditions that improved transportation, for example, through oil, through rails, through communication, and that led to enormous integration. And the developments, the technological developments that we see now is also a subtle combination of, well, better and easier transportation, but especially communication, you know, more efficient logistics based on data processing. That type of development, okay, again, these stars aligning means that we have very fast changes in economic terms, in terms of productivity. And it's exactly those fast changes that are the source of what we call these scale economies, because then there's enormous opportunities and the firm individual who's there first to basically break a market is the one who has chances to shield that market and basically be the dominant firm. Now, it's in the standard way of having what we call typical scale economies, like, you know, you don't want to have two railway lines next to each other. You want to have different trains on that railway line, but you don't want to build two railway lines next to each other to compete. You know, in current days, it's more about platform economies, network economies, that, you know, we want to sell, if you want to go to an auction site like eBay, we want to be on a site where there's many buyers if we have something to sell, and we want to go to a site where there's many sellers if we want something to buy. And so this, what we call network effects, is if you want the modern day scale economy source, right? And it's precisely because these technological aspects, these features of how, you know, things are sold, produced, how people interact, these scale economies, these network economies, that gives rise to the possibility of having this market power. Each, what you call cyclical kind of realization of that, 120 years ago, it was more, you know, pure physical scale. Now it's probably more intangible information scale, but, you know, it creates, again, in both cases, fast technological change that creates a dominance for a few firms who are the first one in that market.
Essentially, these are revolutions, right? The technological revolutions that have lasting impacts for decades on end and create enormous wealth for the first movers in that market, as you noted. I mean, the railways made a few people very, very rich and very wealthy, but were the basis for mobility in the Americas. These were platform technologies, and today we're seeing it with the internet. So I wonder, Jan, is there anything that we as a society, from a policymaking element, is there anything we can learn from that era of the robber barons that can be applied today in terms of dealing with market power?
There's a lot we can learn from that. And I think we should look closely at the evolution. At that time, for maybe personality issues, but Teddy Roosevelt, the then US president, was very proactive in terms of legislation to do something about it. He realized, being a, you know, very coming from a business community in terms of his electorate, he realized that this was bad for the economy. He realized that this was eventually also going to be bad for the business community. And so he took very determinate steps. And in some way, that's where a lot of the antitrust legislation is originated, with the type of steps that he took then. And I think there's cause for optimism. There's reasons why, you know, we can actually address these issues. However, sadly, in the case of that era, the way it came to an end was actually with two world wars and a great depression, right? So we have to kind of, even though there was, I think, very firm action to try and rein this in, to some extent that wasn't possible to stop it completely. Now, of course, also then it was a global phenomenon. It wasn't that the war started in the United States. I mean, it started in Europe. But, you know, we also know that dominant firms, the steel concerns, for example, in Germany for the Second World War, were one of the drivers behind the discontent of the people, the support, the political support that these firms gave in exchange for being able to build their empires. So these are very closely connected.
You know, when you say all these things together, Jan, and I'm thinking here, right, so we saw a revolution in the early 1900s that led to a lot of discontentment and a Great Depression and eventually war. I'm wondering whether we should be worried right now as I take a look at it. But that's a question and a topic for a whole other day, another time. But you did mention a magic word there, Jan, antitrust. And this is something we're hearing a lot more about for different reasons in the US in terms of they're looking at big tech, how they're going to apply antitrust. But when you look at the US in terms of the way they perceive antitrust in general, actually, it's about whether it hurts consumers directly. And that seems to be the problem here, because instead of having direct impacts in terms of prices going up and consumers being unable to afford certain things, there are indirect impacts here, like destruction of competition, which possibly creates fewer choices, less innovation and less competition. So when we look at the antitrust landscape, I guess, does that need to change? And I guess, do we have the political will to do it? Because Teddy Roosevelt, as you mentioned, had the political will. I'm not sure outside of China whether we have the same political will today.
I mean, it's definitely a very hard political problem. Even if the political will was there, the entanglement of, you know, the corporate influence on policy, and this is not just in the United States, this is globally, is you know, these connections are so strong because they determine campaign finance and things like that, that even if the political will is there, you know, being able to get a solution is hard. But I think there is reason for optimism, though. And the reason for optimism is that we know what we have to do. We know what kind of things we, you know, should take into account. One thing is whether it happens. And so then we can discuss, you know, how easy can we get there. We should be concerned because, you know, if we don't do anything, I think the final outcome is going to be very negative. And we have to have a concern about that. And if you say, well, you know, we all live well today, yes, but, you know, in 1910, people said this is the best time we've ever lived. You know, a war can never end this, and 4 years later, that's exactly what happened. So, but what can we do? Let's think a little bit about the things that we can do. I think we have to break the link between politics and policy on antitrust. Mm. Right. So we have an independent central bank because we believe that if politicians mess with inflation, they can do that for political and electoral reasons. This is beneficial for them, but this is not beneficial for the economy. Economists have pointed this out, let's say early on, but let's say in the 70s, by the 90s, late 80s, late, early 90s, we had independent central banks where we said, look, we have to kind of, you know, put this as a separate objective, inflation target 2%. This works very well. I think something similar can and should be done for antitrust policy. I'm arguing for a similar independent competition agency, and that an independent competition agency should be based on independence from politics, but also it should have resources. If you look at the independent central bank to control inflation, we have around, in the US, 30,000 people working in it. In current antitrust, we have around 3,000 people, and it's actually declining. So, you know, if you don't have people who have knowledge, who have expertise to work on it, you know, you cannot solve the problem. If you want to do something about, let's say, tax fraud, well, the best way is to have people pursuing taxation declarations and looking into it. So more kind of investigation of these issues is going to give you better solutions. So that's one thing. But given that you have these independence, what you can also do is deal with this on a case-by-case basis, right? Because doing something about dominance in the retail market is very different from medical devices versus vaccines versus you name it. These are all software that changes so fast. There's nothing to do with vaccines, which, you know, some of them are short-lived, but some of them are really for long term. We still use the polio vaccine that was invented many years ago. And so, you know, kind of every particular market requires particular attention. And we know that in certain circumstances, we have solutions, we have ways of dealing with it. And I think we should basically build institutions that can do that.
And, you know, the big question there is whether we can provide these institutions with resources, right? Have you given any thought to how we would provide that? Maybe would it have to come from the government of the day? Or are we looking at an international body here where multiple governments fund this? Have you given any thought to that?
I mean, the cost in relation to the benefit is actually tiny. You know, the 30,000 people that look after the 2% inflation target and achieve this, okay, they basically, what economists calculated, the benefit of having stable inflation is about 0.5% of GDP. We calculate that the benefit of controlling the market power is around 9% of GDP. So basically, if the value of controlling this is so high, then, you know, there are resources to do that, right? Because, I mean, we're talking about, if we were talking about 30,000 people working here, that's peanuts as a percentage of GDP compared to the gains. And I think that it would be financed with taxation, but it's tiny compared to many of the social programs that we implement. And I'm arguing that, you know, a little bit counterintuitively, that's what the profit paradox is. If you do something about profits, about firms setting the price for, you know, your iPhone costs $1,200 and they could sell it for $300 or $400 at cost, you know, if you do something about that, that's going to be beneficial for wages. It's a long distance. The argument is not trivial, but it's there and we can show that this is the link. And that's why I'm arguing, you know, instead of a lot of social policies trying to prop up wages, let's do something about how firms dominate their markets, and then the benefits will come later on. So I don't think it's an issue of who's going to bear the cost of implementing this, because the cost compared to the benefits is really small.
And I wonder also, because when we take a look at this, globalization in terms of being able to offshore jobs has also played into this, right? And has also made, I guess, the impact, or particularly in the US, in terms of unionization, less potent, because how do you organize a foreign labor force against an employer based in the US? Do you see a role for modern day unionization?
I mean, I think unions are wonderful when they look out for the rights of their workers, for the quality and the circumstances in which these workers operate. I'm not sure that they're the best tools to increase wages, because in a sense, if the objective of the union is to increase wages, it's like the monopoly power on the worker side, right? You're trying to
fight monopoly power with monopoly power.
With monopoly power. And I think, you know, again, once the circumstances, the working conditions are guaranteed, once we're sure that workers can work in safe and acceptable and good conditions, to kind of adjust or to try and affect wages, I think it's much better to actually have more competition rather than less. Because ultimately, my argument is an argument for more competition. I argue that we need more competitive markets. We need more competition in the output market, okay? And eventually, then that's going to resolve the profit paradox. That's going to raise the tide rather than lowering it. And this is going to lead to higher wages.
Jan, I could speak way more about this and really pick your brain on all sorts of things, but that's where we've got to end this conversation today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a great pleasure. It was a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
I've been speaking with economist Jan Eckhout, author of The Profit Paradox, How Thriving Firms Threaten the Future. And you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kandasan for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.